I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Max Wilbert. He's a writer, organizer, and wilderness guide. A third-generation dissident, he came of age in a family of anti-war and undoing racism activists in post-WTO Seattle. He's the editor-in-chief of the Deep Green Resistance News Service. His latest book is Bright Green Lies. His first book, an essay called We Choose to Speak, was released in 2018. He lives in Oregon. Today we talk about actions against a proposed lithium mine in Nevada. And we've talked about this before, but for people who haven't heard, Max, can you give us the background on this place, the background on this action, and just fill us in on everything and then bring us up to date?
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me on, Derek. It's nice to be on the show again, and always a really great time to talk with you. I love you. I love all your interviews and all your other guests, so I really appreciate your work with this show. In fact, I haven't told you this, but I've been thinking at some point about writing an article encouraging people to go back and listen to all the archives of this show. And I wanted to call it a masterclass in organizing, because you've been doing this show for so long and you've talked to so many brilliant people that somebody wanted to learn how to become an activist, a more effective activist. I think just listening to the archives of this show would be a really great way to do that. I've never told you that before. I haven't written that article yet, but I really appreciate all your work here.
Well, thanks for saying that. And it's interesting because they asked me to do this show 7 or 8 years ago, and I didn't really want to do it because I didn't want to just sort of go on air and bloviate. And I mean, not enough happens, frankly, every week for me to find something interesting. I could not fill 45 minutes a week or 50 minutes a week of just my opinions on current events. And so I told them no at first. And then I thought, no, you know what? There's a lot of really good people doing a lot of really good work out there. And if we make it about them and not about me, then this could actually be really interesting. And you're absolutely right. I have spoken with over the years so many people who are doing such, including you, in doing such fantastic work that it makes me happy to be able to give a lot of these people one more opportunity to talk about the important work they're doing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the opportunity to come on the show and talk about Thacker Pass.
Well, let's do that.
Okay. Well, I can describe the basic situation here. So maybe I'll go way back to start. So most people listening to this show are probably familiar with Yellowstone National Park. It's the park with the geysers, right? The hot springs, the geysers, Old Faithful. There's also the buffalo, and there's all the ecological issues around the killing of the buffalo that's still ongoing there. But there's a connection between Yellowstone and this place in northern Nevada, which is today called Thacker Pass. And in the Paiute language, the name for this place is Pahimaha, which translates to Rotten Moon. And I can tell the story of that a little bit later on in the show. But the connection between Yellowstone and here is that 16 million years ago, the hot spot, the magma that comes up through the Earth's crust and heats these hot springs and creates all this geothermal activity in Yellowstone National Park today, 16 million years ago, that was here. That was in this location. And that's why there is lithium in the soil here. Lithium is the third element on the periodic table. It's a metal. It's very lightweight. In this location, it's in the form of a clay. So there was a supervolcano here, just like there is in Yellowstone. And all of this erosion and sedimentation and natural geologic processes after the supervolcano moved along, it created an abundance of lithium in this area. So corporations have been eyeing this lithium for a long time. It was actually first discovered in the 1970s by an oil company that came out to this region actually looking for uranium. There's also uranium and other minerals in the soil around here. And at that time in the 1970s, lithium wasn't very widely used. It was used a little bit in medicine, in chemical production and plastics, used in some rockets and military weapons. Lithium is also used in thermonuclear weapons and different types of nuclear reactors, interestingly. But at that time, the demand for lithium wasn't very high. So it wasn't worth it to build a mine out here. What has changed since the 1970s is that global warming has become a huge focus for the environmental movement, for corporations, for governments all around the world. And with good reason, it should be a focus. It's a serious issue, of course. And what has happened as a result of that is we have seen a boom in the demand for electric vehicles to transition away from gas and diesel powered cars and trucks to electric vehicles. And it's also created a boom in demand for batteries, giant batteries, to store energy from solar and wind power. The sun doesn't shine all the time. The wind doesn't blow all the time. And if you go to flick on your lights in the middle of the night, people expect the lights to work. So if you're going to have a lot of solar energy and a lot of wind power, you need ways to store that energy and provide it to people and businesses when they want it. This is where batteries come in. And the dominant battery technology today is the lithium-ion battery. And this is why there's a huge explosion in the demand for lithium. Do you want to add something there, Derek?
I didn't know that I was being that obvious. I was thinking something, which is that this is one of the things that horrifies me about this culture and that lets us know that this culture is going to grind away at the planet until there's nothing left unless it's stopped, which is that it continues to find new commercial uses for new substances, which leads to new exploitation. So there was no reason 140 years ago for anybody to destroy the soil there and destroy the region there because there was no economic use for lithium. And this is not just this. We find this in gold rushes, diamond rushes, oil rushes, whale rushes, passenger pigeon rushes. It doesn't matter. When they discover some new economic use for some new creature or thing, then, well, sorry, that place is going to go. It happens over and over, and it keeps expanding. So I was thinking about that when you said they discovered in the 1970s, but it wasn't endangered then because the place wasn't endangered because lithium wasn't particularly useful. And then, for crying out loud, we wrote in our book that the same thing happens with sand, that there are islands that no longer exist because they've sand mined them out of existence. So that's what I was just thinking when you were saying some of that, is just how this culture is so good at coming up with new reasons to destroy places to make somebody a buck.
Absolutely. And that really gets to one of the big picture reasons why this is not sustainable. It's not going to help address global warming, and it's not going to save the planet. In fact, the opposite, because we're seeing this explosion in demand for lithium. There are something like 1.6 billion or 1.4 billion cars and trucks in the world today. And the vast, vast majority of those, more than 99%, are internal combustion engine vehicles. They run on gasoline or diesel. And to transition all of those vehicles, to replace all of them with electric cars, would require an incredible amount of batteries. And I just want to throw out a few numbers here to help people get a sense of the scale of this explosion in demand for lithium. The first is a quote from the CEO of American Lithium Corporation, which is different from Lithium Americas, which is the company that wants to mine here at Thacker Pass. He says, "The future demand for lithium is truly staggering. Battery demand is rising at the rate of 2 to 3 mines per year by 2020. That was a quote from a couple years back. And here's another quote from Megan Siebert and Bill Reese, who recently released a scientific paper. I forget the name of the journal they published it in, but this is the quote. It says, "An entire year of production from the world's largest lithium-ion battery manufacturing facility, which is Tesla's $5 billion gigafactory here in Nevada, could store only 3 minutes worth of the annual U.S. electricity demand. Manufacturing a quantity of batteries that could store just 2 days worth of U.S. electrical demand would require 1,000 years of gigafactory battery production. Storing only 24 hours worth of U.S. electricity generation in lithium batteries would cost $11.9 trillion, take up 345 square miles, and weigh 74 million tons at enormous ecological cost." They continue, "A battery-centric future means mining gigatons of rare earth mineral ores. For every kilogram of battery, 500 to 50 to 100 kilograms of ore needs to be mined, transported, and processed. Constructing enough lithium batteries to store only 12 hours worth of daily power consumption would require 18 months worth of global primary energy production and the entire global supply of several minerals. Most people, I think, don't realize how powerful fossil fuels are. And I don't say that as a fan of fossil fuels. I say that as somebody who's been fighting the oil industry, the coal industry, the fracking and gas industry for a decade now, who's taken direct action against those, been involved in multiple campaigns to fight the extremely, extraordinarily destructive fossil fuel industries. Nonetheless, most people who advocate for the transition to electric vehicles, to solar and wind energy, and so on, don't realize how powerful fossil fuels really are, how much energy is embodied in them. And when you consider it, it's really quite obvious, because a fossil fuel is millions of years worth of photosynthesis that's compressed by huge geologic forces into this incredibly energy dense substance, right? And it's simply impossible to replace that with something like solar or wind energy. And to compare lithium ion batteries to oil, the average lithium ion battery today stores about roughly 1/50th as much energy as there is in a gallon of diesel. So for a similar weight of battery versus the same weight in diesel fuel, you've got about 50 times more energy in the fossil fuel. And again, I'm not arguing for fossil fuels here. What I'm saying is that people don't understand the scale of the transition that is being proposed and the amount of damage that that would do to the planet. And that's, you know, Thacker Pass here, Pehemaha, is a case in point, because this mine that is proposed for this one site here in northern Nevada, this is traditional territory occupied land of the northern Paiute and western Shoshone people. Their land was taken by force, by violence. They never signed a treaty. It was annexed unilaterally by the United States government. The mining company wants to destroy 28 square miles for this one lithium mine. Just one mine. And there are thousands of lithium mining claims in the state of Nevada alone. You know, when people come here, I'm looking out right now at the land here. I'm in Thacker Pass right now. I'm in Pehemaha recording this interview with you remotely, Derek. And I'm on the north side of Thacker Pass, which is this broad saddle. It's this broad mountain pass between two flat-topped mountain plateaus. And to the east is the Quinn River Valley. And from where I'm sitting to the eastern side of where this mine project would go is about 7 or 8 miles. It would extend for another mile or two to the west of me, for about half a mile to the north of me, and about 4 miles to the south of me. So this is a massive, massive area that they're talking about destroying. And of course, I'm not sure that I really believe in the concept of sacrifice zones. In fact, I think that's a pretty abhorrent concept. The idea that there are areas in nature that it's fine to destroy. I don't think that's true. I think everywhere is important for one reason or another. And you often share the quote, Derek, that nature is not only more complex than we know, it's more complex than we can know, right? So often when we cause harm to the natural world, or when capitalists, the dominant culture, causes harm to the natural world, they do so ignorant of that harm. They do so not understanding the processes that they're interrupting, the cycles of life and the natural communities that they're destroying are often completely overlooked. They're not understood. They don't even know the damage that they're doing. And so here at Thacker Pass, we do know some things. We know that this is a critical migratory corridor for pronghorn antelope, who are still at a fraction of their historic levels. We know this is important habitat for mule deer.
Wait, let's back up for just a second. I just want to emphasize that, you know, we talk sometimes that there gets to be a fair amount of press about how there were 60 million buffalo and they went down very far. But I don't know the exact numbers. You may. But it ends up that pronghorn antelope, there were, I don't know, 15 million, 25 million, 10 million. there were a lot of pronghorn antelope too, but they don't get as much press.
Yeah, I've actually heard that there were 50 million.
Okay, 50 million.
Yeah, and they went
down to as low as, again, I'm making up the numbers, but it's like 12,000, 20,000. And I think they've recovered up to like 100,000 or something. And again, I could be quite off, but the point is, it's like, great, they've gone from 12,000 to 100,000. But actually what they've done is they've gone from what you just said, 50 million down to 100,000.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the largest herds of pronghorn I've ever seen were in Wyoming when I was driving from actually the Yellowstone area down to the Front Range of Colorado and saw multiple herds of pronghorn with 100, 200 animals. That's something I've never seen before, despite spending a lot of time in Nevada, Utah, throughout the Great Basin and the Intermountain West. I'd never seen herds like that before. You know, that region is getting hammered pretty hard with fracking and especially with coal mining. And in places like here in the Thacker Pass region, we see pronghorn, but usually herds of about between 5 and 20 to 30. I actually saw about 20 or 15 or 20 this morning. And, you know, if you imagine that these pronghorn are maybe at 1 to 2% of their historic numbers, seeing herds of 100, 200, 300 must have been an everyday occurrence basically across the entire Intermountain West for thousands of years. And they're really barely hanging on like so many creatures at this point. You know, another one of those species that's barely hanging on is the greater sage grouse. If people aren't familiar with the sage grouse, they're a sort of chicken-like bird, mostly ground-dwelling bird that lives in the Intermountain West, you know, between the Cascades and the Sierras and the Rocky Mountains. And they feed on sagebrush. They depend on sagebrush very heavily, hence the name sage grouse. And they've been hammered since European colonization. Their numbers are at between 1 and 3% are left. So 97 to 99% of them are gone. And the reasons for this are very clear. It's overgrazing, the cattle really hitting these sagebrush landscapes hard and eating up a lot of the food that the birds rely on. It's oil and gas drilling. It's urban sprawl. It's highways and different types of development. The thing about sage grouse is, like so many species, they're very sensitive. They don't like noise. Even noise from a road, for example, can be really harmful to them. So there, you know, scientists will have numbers. Biologists could tell you the numbers on this. But here at Thacker Pass, there are multiple sage grouse breeding areas on the mountains just to the north of the proposed mine site. And they're within, the closest one is less than a mile, I believe, from the boundary of the mine, the proposed mine. And they're going to be using heavy equipment down here, explosives. It's going to be a very loud operation. And that type of noise has been shown time and time again to result in sage grouse abandoning that breeding area. And these breeding areas are the foundation of the sage grouse species. They're like, they're called leks, and they go back to them year after year after year, generation after generation. They go back to these leks, certain areas on the land, and the males strut and walk around and make their incredible song that you hear in the intro to this podcast, where they inflate these chest sacs. And the females hear them and come flying in from miles around. And this is how the species continues through this beautiful, incredible process. We were lucky enough to walk up there this past April early in the morning. We got up around 4:30 or 5 a.m. and hiked up onto the mountain and snuck in quietly. And they're pretty busy hanging out with each other and doing their things. So you can get relatively close with binoculars and observe them if you're quiet and respectful and not disturb them. And it's incredibly beautiful. It's been inspiring people for thousands of years out here. A lot of the indigenous communities throughout the Intermountain West have special songs or dances or ceremonies somehow related to the sage grouse because they're such an incredible creature. It's an otherworldly experience to be up there in the pre-dawn and to hear the females flying in over your head coming from every direction and hear the males singing. And these leks, these breeding grounds, might be destroyed just by the noise from this project. That's not to mention the thousands of acres of old growth, beautiful sagebrush habitat down here in Thacker Pass itself that would be directly destroyed and bulldozed and crushed by the mining operation itself. And that habitat, this isn't breeding habitat down here, but this is habitat in the wintertime, especially when the top of the mountains up where the leks are full of snow and weather's harsher up there, the winds are stronger. The sage grouse tend to come down in elevation to places like Thacker Pass or Pehemaha to find shelter. And there's so much wildlife that lives in this area. There's spotted skunks and foxes and coyotes. There's mule deer and burrowing owls and meadowlarks and sage thrashers. And the list just goes on and on. There's even an endemic species of snail, which means the only place it lives in the world is here in Thacker Pass, on the west side, northwest side of the pass, in 14 springs that emerge from the mountain. There's a snail who only lives there in the world. That's its entire home, is here. And this is what's at stake for this one lithium mine. So it's important that people recognize that when we are advertised to, when we are marketed to and sold this idea that we need cars, and that they should be electric cars so they don't produce as much carbon dioxide, one of the sacrifice zones for this to happen is places like Thacker Pass. And the species, the beings who are being sacrificed, are those sage grouse. It's those pronghorn antelope. It's those mule deer. It's the golden eagles who nest in this area, who also are basically allergic to a lot of human activity. They don't like noise. They don't like buildings. They'll abandon their nests. They'll leave and never come back. And it's not like there's more habitat opening up elsewhere. This type of destruction is happening all over the state, all over the West, all over the world. So whether it's lithium mines or new highways being constructed or urban sprawl or the expansion of agriculture, oil and gas drilling, just a huge influx of hunters into an area, whatever it is, there are too many people doing too much destructive activity, and the wildlife, the land itself, the water, they're all dying the death of a thousand cuts out
here. So would you rather talk about next what is happening now at Thacker Pass, or would you rather talk about the history of your involvement and then bring us up to the current day?
Well, I'll run through some of the history quickly. People can go back and listen to the last show when we talked about that in more detail. But basically, the short version is I learned about this mine, this proposed mine, when we were researching for Bright Green Lies. And I decided to visit the site back in October of last year, almost exactly a year ago from when we're recording this. And when I visited the land here, I fell in love with it. It's beautiful. It's an incredible place. And it's one thing to love a place that is well protected, like a forest inside a national park, for example, right? There are threats to it. Global warming's a threat. Air pollution, overuse from tourists and so on. All these things can be a threat. But it's different to love a place that's on the chopping block imminently, right? That has the headsman's axe hanging over its neck. And especially to love a place like this that feels so unloved to many, by many people, right? There aren't many people who are questioning the electric vehicle narrative, who are fighting to protect places like this. There are some. There are certainly some. There are people fighting industrial wind and solar energy developments here in Nevada, in other places all over the world, in Hawaii, in Norway and Sami territory, all over the world, people are fighting these types of projects in Mexico, in Colombia. And there are also people fighting lithium mining all over the world, whether it's in Chile or Argentina or Serbia or Portugal, or here in the United States. There are people fighting back against this, but we're in the minority because so many people have been convinced that this is how we save the planet. You know, Derek, you have talked a lot about the book, The Nazi Doctors. What was that guy's name?
Robert J. Lipton.
Yeah, right. And he talked about the claim to virtue, right? Where if you're going to commit a mass atrocity, you need to have a justification for it. Because some people are sociopaths and they're just willing to just hurt people for no reason and be evil for no reason. But most people aren't sociopaths, right? So the only way to get them to go along with an incredibly destructive process is to justify it to them in their minds. And this is what we're seeing here at Thacker Pass and all over the world with this transition to a green economy. We're seeing the justification being laid out for the commitment of a mass atrocity across the entire planet. And, you know, visiting this place and seeing what was at stake and realizing that nobody was going to fight for it unless I stood up and fought for it, it put a lot of pressure on me. It put a lot of pressure on me, right? Because it's easy to stay home and say, this is right and that's wrong, and these are my morals and this is what I believe in. But it's a lot harder to do something about it. You know, it's a lot harder, for example, to do what you do, Derek, and write 30 books about it and, you know, work to change discourse and to put in hour after week after month after year after decade of hard work, you know, to build people's consciousness and to cheer people on and help people articulate their ideas and build strategy and help organize groups and so on. You know, you've done that work. You've put in the time. That's a lot harder than just sitting at home and saying, you know, we should save the forest or we should not blow up the mountain, right? And that was what I was feeling back in October, November, when after I'd visited this site and I knew that it was on the brink of destruction and I wanted to stop it, I felt a lot of pressure. I felt like I've got to put my money where my mouth is. And so along with Will Falk, we set up a protest camp here on the site of the mine. That's where I'm sitting right now, in the middle of what would become a open pit mine, 400 feet deep and several square miles in size. We set up camp on January 15th. And so this is going to air this coming weekend, I believe. So we'll basically be right at the 9-month anniversary that people have been on site for that entire time with no breaks. Some people have been rotating in and out, of course. Not people haven't been here the whole time unbroken, but I've been here more often than not for the last 9 months trying to fight to save this place. And we're taking a bunch of different strategies. We are fighting in the courts. There are 3 lawsuits against this project. One is by some environmental groups. One is from a local rancher, and one is from several tribes and native organizations in this area. And Will Falk is actually the attorney on that case. He's a really good friend of mine and co-founded this camp here with me. We're fighting in the public opinion realm. So we're engaging in outreach and doing interviews like this, talking to the media, writing essays and making videos and doing photography, trying to explain to people what's really going on out here. We're working to put pressure on public officials and on the agencies that are responsible to this, for this, like the Bureau of Land Management, which is part of the Department of the Interior under Secretary Deb Haaland, the first Indigenous Secretary of the Interior. And we're also engaging in direct action. We're here on the land. We are protecting this place. Our bodies are here on the line. And if they try and show up to destroy it, then I think there's a high likelihood that some people are going to put their bodies between the machines and the land.
So before we talk a little bit more about the campaign itself, I want to go back to, I think this is so crucial. How and I want for listeners to be able to picture themselves doing this and to how do you get from, gosh, this is so terrible, I wish somebody would do something about it, but I'm afraid nobody's going to going, well, shoot, I guess I need to go do it. How do you that transition always, I've sort of done the same thing with my books. For years I was complaining, gosh, there were some books that I wish somebody would write. And then finally, years later, it occurred to me, well, maybe I should just do it. But frankly, I think your work is way more important. But how do you get there? How do you get from, do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And I guess there are two sort of answers to that. And the slower answer to that is that I have been committed to this type of land defense and to the planet for more than a decade now. And so in one sense, building up towards taking action like this takes a long time. And it has taken a lot of commitment and just trying to get out there. You know, I've done everything over that past decade that you can imagine. I've written letters to the editor. I've made phone calls to politicians. I've been part of protests. I've gone and engaged in some direct actions. I have tried to go out and support different camps and campaigns like this. I have signed on as a litigant to a lawsuit that somebody else was doing. I have just tried a bunch of stuff. So in one sense, you know, I think doing something like this is part of that extended process of trying to figure out what does it really mean to show our solidarity and live our solidarity with non-human life, with the earth, with the water, the mountains, with this, you know, this incredible creation. I don't say that as a creationist per se, but with this creation that we are so blessed to get to be a part of. You know, and on the other hand, I think there's sort of the shorter answer to that question, which is that, you know, after visiting this site and falling in love with it, particularly, a lot of the questions that we had to deal with were just practical. You know, how are we going to stay warm? Do we have the right boots to get out there in January and have warm feet? Where are we going to get some firewood? What kind of tent are we going to try and get so we can stay warm? How do we get our supplies together? And then other logistical questions like who can help us with outreach? Who can help run a website? Who can come out and join us on site or deliver supplies to us? Can we get some legal support to help protect us from threats and so on? A lot of practical questions like that. But I think in a big sense and an important sense, any project like this, any worthwhile project of any sort, there is a big element of jumping off the diving board, right? There's a big element of, you know, it's like when you walk up to a cliff jump at a lake, if anybody's ever jumped off a cliff into the water or something like that, or jumped off the high dive, you know, at a swimming pool, you're nervous, right? You don't know exactly what's going to happen before you jump. And there's a big element of faith. There's a big element of just moving forward, because there's so many times that you can talk yourself out of it. And, you know, I say this now, 9 months into the campaign, it's hard work. It's grueling. You know, I have a home. I have a beautiful little wood cabin that I live in. My fiance is back home. You know, there's good food in the fridge. There's chanterelles in the forest that we could be out picking right now. You know, my friends are back there. My family, you know, I miss my nephews. Like, it kind of sucks to be out here doing this, right? Like, it's not like this is the best time ever. And I wish that I was doing this all the time in my life. Sure, there's some really wonderful and beautiful things about it. I've made some incredible friends spending all this time on the land. It's also just practically, it's pretty grueling work. And And so there's a big element of just going for it, right? There's a big element of just surrender and just saying, you know what? This is bigger than me. This is bigger than my comfort. And this is something that I want to do. And, you know, I was just actually talking the other day with Joshua Wright, who you know as well, the young filmmaker and forest defense activist. And he helped start the Fairy Creek blockade up in Canada that's now been going on for 14 months. And that's the largest civil disobedience action in Canadian history by the number of arrests. That whole campaign started when he was on Google Earth and he saw some roads cutting into this old growth forest. And he got really upset about it. And he gave me a phone call and he said, I'm worried about this old growth forest. I want to figure out how to save it. And I said, I don't even remember what I told him. You know, we just chatted and I probably shared some ideas. We discussed things a little bit. And, you know, it wasn't like he went into that with a great plan of how exactly everything was going to go. And he had all the resources he needed and he had thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank and a team of lawyers on call and all that stuff. You know, you start with nothing or almost nothing and you figure it out as you go along. You know, and I think that the most important step in that process is the emotional step of feeling fear, feeling trepidation, and feeling the unknown, and just deciding, you know, screw it. We're gonna go for this. We're gonna do it. And, you know, I hope that people build up the support systems that they need to be able to do this kind of work. You know, in terms of family and friends and you know, trying to get your life together in the different ways that are necessary that enable you to do this kind of thing, because we need a lot more of this. And it's practically speaking, it's not easy to do, but I think it's really important.
This reminds me of a few things. One of them is I've always loved the line by Florence Nightingale, which was, I've always attributed my success to the fact that I never gave nor took an excuse. And when I was in my mid-20s, I wanted to be a writer, but I was too scared to do it. And I thought, you know, I was abused as a kid, so it's just all too scary. I don't want to do it. And then one evening, I still remember exactly where I was in the grocery store parking lot in Spirit Lake, Idaho, just walking across the parking lot, when I realized I can go the rest of my life thinking I have the best excuse in the world for not writing because it's too scary, or I can just be a writer. And that moment changed everything for me. So we all have all these reasons that we cannot do whatever actions, or we can do them. And that was one thing. And another thing is, what you're saying about not knowing everything that's going to happen before you start. I think about some of the best advice my mom ever gave me was from her grandmother, which was, it's a cliche, but yard by yard, life's hard. Inch by inch, life's a cinch. People ask me all the time, gosh, how do you write a big book? And the answer is I don't. I write a page. And then tomorrow I write another page. And the day after that I write another page. And then a year later I've got a whole book. And sort of maybe it's the same here, that you don't go in knowing everything, but just you go in and you figure out, how am I going to keep my feet warm? And then that's it. And then tomorrow you figure out, okay, who can do some public outreach? And the day after that, it's like, okay, so there's lots of different groups here. Maybe I should talk to some ranchers. And maybe I should talk to the Indians who have lived here forever. And I mean, is that reasonably accurate?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's been incredibly important to have that inch by inch approach, I think, because, you know, I've been saying since we got here, everything has been so uncertain. You know, we haven't had a single month where we felt safe. Everything was secure. There were no problems. You know, everything was going on. We probably haven't had a week like that, right? Maybe a few days here and there at a time where our stress level goes down. But there's always something to deal with. There's always something that comes up. And so it's really important for us to just be able to try and focus and just say, okay, this is what we need to get done today. And this is what we're going to focus on tomorrow. And then the next day, who knows, because something else is probably going to come up and we're going to deal with that and respond to that. I think that the mining company didn't expect this level of opposition. They expected people to just go along with it because that's what people usually do. And so I think people would be surprised at what we can achieve if we actually try. And I was lucky enough to be mentored by some older activists when I was really coming of age as a community organizer, you know, a decade ago. Well, when I, you know, started to take it more seriously, at least. And one of the things that they taught me was that the most important thing is to just show up and not give up. And that's so true. And it doesn't really matter what the issue is. If you're willing to just be committed and show up again and again and again and not give up, then you're going to make some sort of difference. And, you know, that doesn't mean that you're going to save the world and figure out every problem, because that's just not the world that we're living in right now. But we can achieve a lot more than we think if we just show up and, you know, try to do the best.
So we only have 5 or 6 or 7 minutes left. And can you talk about two things I would like for you to really cover? One of them is, can you talk about what the local reception has been to this? Is there a lot of local support? And then the other thing is, I want to really emphasize two things. One is, how can people do something similar in their own places? But also, where are you at right now with this whole campaign? And what can people do? What do you need? And what can people do to help? So there's three questions there. Did you get them?
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, as far as the local reception, it's been overwhelmingly positive. The vast majority of local people are strongly opposed to this mine. And that doesn't matter whether they are from the ranching and farming communities, which are generally quite conservative and almost all white, or from the indigenous communities, from the surrounding reservations. You can find a few people here and there that support the mine, and especially in business, in the Chamber of Commerce, in places like that, you'll find plenty of mine supporters. But in terms of everyday people, maybe 90% of the locals are against it. So we've found a good reception from people here. I've talked to folks from the gas station to the post office to the Humboldt Gun Club to the community meetings, and almost everyone has been very respectful and very positive about what we're doing here. I think part of that is because we've tried to take a professional approach to this, right? We've tried to take an approach that is very mature and forceful and clear. So we're not just going around yelling slogans to show how cool and badass and radical we are, right? We're not just going out and sort of taking these symbolic actions to just show that we're the most radical activists out there. We're really trying to stop this mine. And that doesn't mean we're lying. We're telling the truth about who we are and what we believe and what our politics are. But we're also trying to do that in a very mature way, in a very clear way. And I think, Derek, you've done so much work on the culture of the left and how childish in many ways it is these days. And we're trying to get away from that. We're trying to avoid those traps and those pitfalls. And, you know, the reception has also been incredible from the native community from the Fort McDermitt Paiute Shoshone Reservation, which we have been working really closely with some folks from a group called People of Red Mountain that has come together to oppose this mine and other mines in the region, including other proposed lithium mines. And folks from the Burns Paiute tribe, the Reno Sparks Indian Colony, the Duck Valley Reservation, and many other the surrounding indigenous communities. A lot of really good people who are standing against this mine. Because this is it's a sacred site. There were two massacres that took place on this land. One was a conflict between two different tribes, and one was committed by the U.S. government and the military in 1865. Ironically, or sort of interestingly, that was chronicled by the labor organizer Bill Haywood in his autobiography, which is where we found that information, which
I just found fascinating and really reminded me, Derek, of that line that you wrote about holding hands through history with people who have resisted capitalism and exploitation of workers and destruction of land. You know, that piece that you wrote on that topic just brings tears to my eyes every time I read it. And I really felt the spirit of Big Bill Haywood reaching out through the last century to, you know, just extend a hand to us and send solidarity from that time to the present. As far as how people can do something similar, I think that, you know, if people want to reach out to me and have a conversation about what's going on in their area, I'm always happy to share knowledge and share ideas and ask questions and try and help people get on the right direction. I think, you know, trying to get a team together, even a small team, you know, this was just started by a handful of us. But, you know, it wasn't just one. It wasn't just two. It was a small group. That makes a big difference, especially if they're people you know and can trust and like to be around and work with. That helps a lot. So those are two big factors there. And your final question, Derek, was what's happening right now and what can people do to get involved? What's happening right now is that the BLM is threatening to come in here as soon as October 22nd and start doing an archaeological dig, which the native people are calling for-profit looting. For-profit looting of their cultural sites, the massacre site, the sacred sites out here. This would be done by a for-profit archaeology company that would be hired to come in and pull out artifacts and remove whatever they find from the site, which is legally required before the mine can go forward. So we have multiple tribes suing the BLM, writing letters to the BLM, speaking out in the media, opposing this desecration, and we're supporting them. That could happen as soon as October 22nd, as I said. And so we're hoping to get more people out on the site. We want people to call public officials, including Deb Holland at the Department of the Interior, the new head of the Bureau of Land Management, Tracy Stone Manning. Let them know what's going on. Leave a message with their assistance, with any people. Put pressure on those agencies. Help us reach out to media and get this story out there further and further. We need more people to come to camp and spend time here, especially people who can be trusted to hold things down, to make smart decisions, to not be rash about what's going on. We need folks to come and help us hold down the site. As we're moving into the winter, it's getting pretty harsh out here in terms of the weather. It can be cold and windy. We had our first snow the other day. Didn't really stick around, but it was blowing in sideways for a little while there. And so we need people who are willing to come out and stand with us on the site, and endure that kind of winter weather. We're not really sure, like I said, how exactly this is going to play out. It's possible that a bunch of folks could be in jail by, this time next month and the mine construction will be moving forward. It's also possible that we'll have pushed them back and, had some sort of small victories on this project. We just don't know. It's really up in the air. And so we need whatever help people can offer us, platforms, bodies, you know, people out here on the front lines, any sort of legal help, donations. So folks can learn more on our website, which is protectthackerpass.org. And I hope to see some of you out here on the land.
So I have maybe one or two questions that I know this is unfair for me to throw in real late, but one of them is, so if people are out there all day, what do you do all day? And can you, you've done a really good job of this before, but can you, I mean, do you sit around and read? Do you sit around and talk? Do you take walks through the, what do you do while you're waiting?
Yeah, we definitely do a lot of that. You know, for myself, I've got a little office set up here and I'm doing a lot of that type of work, phone calls, emails, interviews like this one, writing press releases and so on. A lot of the people who come out may not have experience with that side of community organizing. If they do, we encourage people to do that kind of work from this location. to reach out to people, to have those conversations. Certainly to spend time on the land. That's really important for us, to have people fall in love with this place. But, you know, if you're coming up as a visitor, there's chores that need to be done. There's dishes that need to get washed. Some people come up and make art or banners and put them up. Some people come up and do photography. We like to sit around the fire and have conversations in the evening. It's an incredibly beautiful place to be. And, you know, it's a very peaceful place. So, you know, it's not hard to be here. I've really enjoyed all the time that I've spent out here, and especially when I get a chance to take a hike up the mountain. You know, you can just walk straight out of camp and take a 10-mile hike through what's essentially a wilderness area anytime you want.
So people don't have to specifically be experienced activists. They can be fairly inexperienced. And if they show up, you or somebody else will give them tasks. They don't have to like show up and know everything.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right. We've had a lot of people come up, you know, of all ages. We've had families come up. We are welcoming anyone to join us on site who is opposed to the mine. We are recommending, especially as we move into the winter, that people dress warm, bring some good clothes and, you know, warm sleeping bag and blankets. Cheap tents can get destroyed by the wind up here pretty easily. So it's best to sleep in your car if you don't have a very sturdy tent as we start to move into the winter. But anyone is welcome who is opposed to the mine and who's prepared to, you know, follow our very basic ground rules for camp.
And then last question. You've done a really good job of this so far, but can you give us one incident or anecdote that will help people fall in love with the landscape? Like one, you said you saw herds of pronghorn. Give us one nature story that you just love and you haven't really had the opportunity to tell.
We haven't seen the golden eagles all summer long. They have been hunting up in the mountains and further away. And 2 days ago, I was sitting around the fire with two of the native elders, the grandmothers from the Fort McDermitt Reservation, who have been deeply involved in opposing this mine. And we were just sitting around the fire. They had said some prayers for the campaign and what we're trying to do out here. And one of them looks up all of a sudden and she says, "What's that up on the ridgeline?" And I look up there and I can barely see what she's seeing. This woman is in her 70s and, you know, is looking at the ridgeline, which is about a mile and a half away. And so we pull out the binoculars and it's a golden eagle sitting up there on the ridgeline. And we watch the eagle. It was the first golden eagle we've seen, like I said, for at least 2 or 3 months. And every time we have an experience with the wildlife out here, it feels like the land is speaking to us. We are trying our best to listen and figure out what those messages mean. And it's all around us. This land is just speaking constantly. And being out here, it gives you the opportunity and the space and the stillness and the quiet to listen and to try to make sense of what the land is telling us. Sometimes those lessons don't, you know, easily translate into English words or sentences. Sometimes there are lessons that just sort of sink into your bones. But there's something about being out here. You know, the one of the elders said a while back, the mining company executives come out here and they look out on this land and they see a resource. They see a wasteland waiting to be exploited. But the elders come out here and we look out on this land and we see everything we need to survive is here. You know, so I really encourage people to come out here and just get a taste of that.
Well, thank you so much for that, Max, and thank you for your work and your friendship for all these years, and thank you for your work in the world, and thank you for work at Thacker Pass, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Max Wilbert. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.